so indelibly imprinted on his heart flowed into his ear. A new job, a new relationship, and new possibilities. He had no idea what she'd seen in Louis Gould. Sure, he'd been good-looking. Then there were the rippling muscles and wealth. He'd also had that whole international super-spy thing going on. Some chicks were into that, Moreau supposed. But if you took all those things away, he was just a violent dick. Maybe she was ready for a change. Perhaps something with a cultured, intellectual thief. A man who could enjoy art and food and wine. Someone who could show her the world through a lens not smeared with blood. He let out a quiet breath. But before he started planning his future with her, he needed to get this job done. He didn't get to steal anything. His instructions were just to set up some surveillance. Video was simple. The stupid glass house again. But audio would be a bit more interesting. He'd have to get in close enough to do some hand drilling, and as easy as it was to see into the building, it would be almost equally easy to see out. Moreau crept forward a few meters, and then stopped again for another quick scan of his surroundings. The landscaping was spread out and tasteful. Unlike most of his countrymen, El Hashem had resisted installing gilt statues of cherubs peeing into fountains. Moreau avoided increasingly bright splashes of light as he closed in on the structure. El Hashem was still riding away, and one of his guards was in the living room, a fit-looking man of the type who wore sunglasses at night. Where was the other? Likely somewhere in the house, but making an assumption like that would be an amateurish mistake. Could he be patrolling the exterior? Had he seen Moreau go over the wall? And was he now creeping up from behind? Unlikely, but still his absence added a little spice to the drudgery of this gig. The Frenchman followed a deep shadow to a tree he'd found with a drone flyover. It was one of four surveillance angles he'd need, and the branches looked sturdy enough to support his 65 kilos. 6 or 7 meters would be high enough to make the camera invisible from the ground, and to keep the solar panel in the light. He began fishing a unit out of his backpack, but then stopped when he saw the security man inside head toward the stairs. A changing of the guard? Would he finally discover the location of the other man? Confirmation that he was inside would allow Moreau to move much more quickly and remove all danger of being late for his dinner reservation. The guard went up the steps, walking with a level of caution that seemed a bit odd. Maybe El Hashem was one of those rich assholes who didn't like to see or hear his staff. Moreau himself had once worked in a similar environment. He'd left that job with his employer's Bentley and the contents of his safe. The guard stopped in the doorway of the room occupied by El Hashem, raised his gun, and fired a single round. It hit the Arab in the head and pitched him forward onto his desk. Moreau froze. Had that really just happened? Was he having a flashback from the drugs he'd been so enamored with at university? Were flashbacks really even a thing? The guard walked calmly over and yanked what was left of the dead man's head back. It was enough to break Moreau from his trance, and he panicked. Scooping up his pack, he began sprinting toward the perimeter wall. Coming around the thick stump of an ancient tree, he suddenly found himself skidding face first through the dirt. When he glanced back to see what had tripped him, he vomited into the dry leaves. The guard he'd been looking for was lying on his back, staring up at the sky with part of his head missing. Moreau forced himself to his feet and stumbled to the tree he'd used to access the compound. He shot up it, pausing reluctantly on top of the wall to ensure that the street was still empty. A moment later, he was walking with an awkward, hurried gait toward his vehicle. It was the longest 6 minutes and 12 seconds he'd ever spent, but finally he slid behind the wheel and pulled out. His breath was coming too fast, making him lightheaded, but not so much that he couldn't dial Claudia. She picked up on the first ring.
Julien, where... They killed him, he screamed. You screwed me. You didn't say anything about anyone getting murdered.
Her voice carried its normal sensual calm. Do you ever check your messages? He glanced at the phone screen. 3 from her.
Fuck,
he said, unable to come up with anything more relevant. I need you to calm down, Julia. Tell me what happened.
Are you deaf? They killed him.
Who killed whom?
One of the guards. He killed El Hashem. I saw it. He did it right in front of me. In that fucking glass house. It was like watching a movie.
I understand. But you, the other guard's dead too. Part of his head was gone.
I tripped over him.
Moreau suddenly bolted straight up in his seat.
Oh my God. His blood. I think I have his blood on me.
Julien, stop talking and breathe, okay? I need you to go through with me exactly what happened.
Have you not been listening? Don't ever call me again.
He disconnected and pulled onto a more heavily traveled street. For some reason, the cars moving around him brought back a little of his calm. He glanced at the phone in the passenger seat, but resisted reaching for it. After another minute, he caved. How could he stay mad at such a magnificent woman? Not surprisingly, it didn't take her long to answer.
Are you all right, Julien? Are you hurt?
I'm fine.
Where are you now?
In the car, headed back to the city center.
Okay, good. Now tell me this. Were both men shot in the head?
Yes.
Could you see the kind of gun?
What the hell do I know about guns? I've never shot one in my life.
Because you know about everything,
came the soothing answer.
Flattery? Really? Did she think he was that easy?
Shit. Of course she did. And she was right. I was pretty far away. It had a silencer for sure. If I had to guess, I'd say a Glock.
Did you leave anything behind? Was the cameras installed?
No, nothing.
Good. I've tripled your fee.
You'll find the money in the account we discussed. I'd suggest you get out of France for a while. And that you forget you ever heard of me, or Ahmed El Hashem.
Chapter 36. Over Algeria. Rapp fished around in the tiny refrigerator, finally finding a beer at the back. His plan had been to ease up on the drinking until he managed to pull his life together. But since things seemed to be rocketing in the other direction, fuck it. The door to the cockpit was closed, but he glanced in that direction anyway. The man inside was another one of Claudia's, a drug runner out of Colombia. Not Scott Coleman by a long shot, but a solid pilot with a set of torture scars that suggested he knew how to keep his mouth shut.
Everyone's back in Juba, but there seem to be some problems,
Claudia said as he sat down in a facing seat.
What kind of problems? The man you killed. Apparently the rebel leader he works for wasn't happy. He has people watching the church.
According to Kent, it would be suicide to go back. They've rented an empty safari hotel outside of town and are holding up there until we arrive.
Fine.
She leaned forward in her seat with a concerned expression.
We need to talk about what happened in Brussels and Paris.
It wasn't a subject that was going to improve his mood, but there was no getting around it. Ali Nassar was making his play, and it was a good one. A decision had to be made about what to do. The president had asked him to find the highly placed Saudis allied with ISIS and kill them. Rapp intended to carry out that request, but the question now was how. Did he try to get clever and save himself, or did he just move forward with the hammer?
The man was killed with a single shot from a 9mm. To authorities, it will also look like he was first tortured for information. El Hashem died the same way, and unless I miss my guess, he'll be found tied to a chair with the same kind of injuries.
Sound like anyone you know? Doesn't ring a bell.
And there are witnesses, Mitch. The security men you put down in the hotel, as well as the people you talked to in the elevator. I'm also guessing that the bodyguard who took out El-Hashem is giving the police your description and telling them about how he barely escaped with his life. Is that all? No. There are still the cameras in Monaco, as well as all the eyewitnesses who survived the attack. She leaned back. That's all. It's hard to complain about Nassar doing my job for me. At this rate, he'll have his entire network wiped out by next week. He's framing you, Mitch. If someone showed me all this, even I'd think you were killing wealthy Saudis and shooting up nightclubs. We need to shift our focus to clearing you. We can easily argue that you discovered the threat to Terry's at the last second and were trying to stop the terrorists and save the prince. It's not airtight, but it will play. I can probably patch together some reasonably convincing evidence that you weren't in Paris at the time El-Hashem was killed. That just leaves Brussels. It's a harder problem. But if we can demonstrate a pattern of... That's all fine and good, Claudia. But what about Nassar? What about him? He's partnering with ISIS. In all likelihood, he's going to use their power in the region to help him take over when King Faisal dies. Then Mullah Halabi won't be flailing around with assault rifles and suicide vests. He'll be backed by Saudi Arabia's military and intelligence capability. He could conceivably use that to march straight across the Middle East. How is any of that your problem, Mitch? Tell Irene what you've discovered and let the Americans handle it. I think you're missing the fact that I am the Americans. I'm not your husband. I'm not a contract killer. My job is to stop millions of people from being murdered by a bunch of fundamentalist psychos. No, it isn't. You don't work for the CIA anymore. We've talked about this, Mitch. Everyone's going to walk away from you. All the people you've kept from harm, all the politicians you've made look good, all the operatives you've bled with. By this time next week, I wouldn't be surprised if Scott's men are chasing us around the world. It's not just my job, Claudia. It's what I believe in. It's who I am. Well, stop believing in it and be someone else, she said, her voice filling the tiny plane. You've given enough of yourself to these people. Maybe it's time for you to move on. She folded her arms across her chest and tried to stare him down. I've been in worse situations. Really? No, I was just trying to sound positive. I appreciate the effort. Mitch, she started, choosing her words carefully. I think this might be harder for you than you expect. I know the physical danger matters very little to you. But are you ready for your country to turn on you? I don't suppose I have much of a choice. But the others do. Their motivations are different than yours. You asked them to help you capture a Saudi prince. Donatello would seduce him. He'd be drugged, and they'd be paid. Now you're about to ask them to go after the Saudi intelligence chief, while being opposed by America and all its resources. I know people like this, Mitch. They're not going to hold together much longer. Then we'll have to move fast. Fast, she repeated under her breath. Would you at least do one thing for me? Open a channel to Irene. Tell her what you've found and ask her what her plans are. He shook his head. I'm not going to get her involved in killing the intelligence director of an ally, Claudia. If it ever came out that she even knew about it, she'd end up in jail, and our partnerships all across the Middle East would collapse. If she wants to talk, she has my number. Chapter 37 Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Ali Nassar stood next to King Faisal on the tarmac, waiting for a set of stairs to be pushed up to his private Airbus A380. The plane had been in a holding pattern for over 2 hours to allow the sun to set. The aging monarch could no longer tolerate the afternoon heat.
It was an ironic weakness for a man who ruled the desert kingdom, and yet another indication that the order of things would soon be changing. A group of formally dressed men appeared in the doorway, carrying a coffin draped in a Saudi flag. They descended with a level of care and solemnity that bordered on the comic. Beyond having been born to the king's favorite sister, Prince Talal bin Musaid had lived his life as a spoiled, useless child. It was odd that a man whose life had been so inconsequential could be so dangerous in death. The actions against Zaman and El Hashem had been forced by bin Musaid, as was the continued dismantling of the network Nassar had so carefully built. The Saudi intelligence apparatus was in turmoil as the royals shrank in horror at one of their own being targeted by the radical forces they themselves had created. The vulnerability the nobles suddenly felt had put a strain on his relationship with the king, instantly reversing the gains he'd made by convincing ISIS to attenuate its public criticism of him. Strife and chaos always traveled hand in hand with opportunity, though. It was just a question of whether one was strong and clever enough to take advantage. Faisal began to shuffle forward, and Nassar followed at a respectful distance. The pallbearers stopped and allowed the king to run a hand over the flag. His face was uncharacteristically hard to read. Was he feeling grief for a self-indulgent boy who had betrayed him? Anger at the fact that the royalty, and not just its subjects, were now at risk? Or was this just a reminder of the mortality that he felt more keenly with every passing day? Faisal finally stepped back, allowing the men to continue to the hearse as he returned to his limousine. "Who were these murderers?" the king said as Nassar slid in next to him. "Former Iraqi soldiers who joined ISIS. I want them destroyed. I want ISIS destroyed. No more middle ground. No more cowering behind the Americans. I want their heads, and the heads of anyone who has even hinted at supporting them."
"Your Majesty,
what, Ali? Are you going to say that this is a delicate matter? That we have to proceed with caution? That I have to hide behind the walls of my palace while these cowards plot how to put a knife in my back?"
"It's not just a delicate matter, Highness. It's a complicated one."
"Complicated how?"
"We now have sharpened video composites from MI6, and based on them, we are reasonably certain that Mitch Rapp was the man who carried bin Musaid out of the nightclub."
"Mitch Rapp," the king said, twisting toward him. "How certain?"
75%. Faisal faced forward again and nodded knowingly.
"I wonder, Ali. You seem to have a personal animosity for Mr. Rapp that I don't share. He risked his life to save my kingdom from a nuclear holocaust. Without him, I doubt we would have a country to discuss."
The implication was clear, that Nassar had provided no service in his lifetime that could rival those of this vile American. The king was dazzled by the man, rapt with tales of his exploits and seduced by the illusion of being under his protection. It would be a difficult task to break the old fool of his obsession with Rapp, but not an impossible one.
"Your Highness, I think you have to consider the fact that Rapp's appearance in that nightclub just as it was attacked is coincidental to the point of absurdity. Perhaps the CIA became aware of the threat and he was there to thwart it. I've watched the video too, Ali, and it's quite apparent that his primary objective was to save the prince."
The monarch's tone was defensive enough that Nassar had to suppress a smile. The man was aware that his argument was ludicrous. He just needed to be forced to admit it.
"Our analysts do not believe this to be the case, Highness. First, as we both know, Mr. Rapp has left the employ of the CIA, and as far as we can tell has cut off all contact with his former colleagues. Second,
We know that he suspected the prince of financing terrorists. The idea that a man like Rapp would try to protect the prince stretches credibility to the breaking point.
And what else do your clever analysts say? Faisal asked coldly.
We think it's feasible, perhaps even likely, that Rapp was behind this attack. The king let out a laugh, strangled by his deteriorating lungs.
That's insane, Ali. It's everything he's fought against his entire life.
True. But consider the following, Your Highness. We know that as a young man he was violently opposed to the pact our governments made to bury the evidence of Saudi involvement in 9/11. And, at a minimum, he would have seen Prince bin Musaid's activities as a betrayal of that pact. More likely, he would have seen it as an indication of a larger conspiracy.
Your point, Ali.
Why would Mitch Rapp, one of the most powerful and effective cogs in the American intelligence machine, suddenly quit? We suspect that it's because he wanted to investigate bin Musaid's actions further, and was blocked by the president, who would be concerned by the potential fallout from such an investigation.
I'm not convinced, Ali.
Then let me provide you with additional evidence. He retrieved a tablet from his briefcase, and Faisal looked down at the photo on it with red-rimmed eyes.
Ahmet.
Yes, sir. Details of Assistant Ambassador El Hashem's murder are now coming in from French authorities. As you can see, he was tied to a chair, tortured, and then shot in the head with a single 9mm bullet. Nassar swiped to the next photo. And this, though unrecognizable because of the blood and damage, is Maya Zaman, a businessman I believe you're acquainted with. Faisal looked up at him.
One of your closest friends. Isn't that true, Ali?
Yes, Highness. We've known each other since we were children.
What happened?
Precisely the same thing. He was bound, tortured, and killed with a bullet to the head.
And you suspect Mitch Rapp?
This goes far beyond simple suspicion, Your Highness. El Hashem's guard barely escaped with his life, and his description of the man who attacked the ambassador matches Rapp. Further, a man leaving Zaman's hotel room was confronted by two security guards. He subdued them both in a matter of seconds. They, as well as a French couple who actually spoke with the man, described someone very similar in appearance to Rapp. But why Zaman and El Hashem? Do we have any reason to believe that they were involved in aiding ISIS?
No, but we're looking deeper.
Be mindful of the fact that they wouldn't necessarily have to be involved for Rapp to come for them. He's no longer bound by American laws or CIA regulations. All he would need is some vague suspicion that they had information, even unwittingly, that could help him.
Despite the cool interior of the limousine, sweat began to glisten on Faisal's face. It wasn't surprising. He had been the driving force behind the deal struck with the Americans after 9/11. And more important, he was responsible for making sure that the Saudi end of the agreement was honored. At that moment, he would be wondering if he might be Rapp's next target.
Your Highness, Nassar said, softening his tone. This entire matter is easily resolved. We simply need to speak with the American authorities and request a meeting with Mr. Rapp. If he's not responsible for any of this, it should be a trivial matter for him to prove it.
Faisal didn't react for a long time, but finally he spoke.
You're right, Ali. With the evidence we have, it is entirely reasonable that we would want to speak with Mitch. I imagine that Irene Kennedy and the President feel the same. All he has to do is provide evidence of his whereabouts during these attacks. As you say, a simple matter.
Precisely, Highness. And if the Americans are unable to produce Mr. Rapp, I think it's also reasonable that we solicit their help in finding him. Wouldn't you agree? I'm sure they're as anxious to clear this up as we are.
Chapter 38. Juba, South Sudan. "Turn left up here," Rapp said, glancing at the GPS on the dashboard. His Glock was resting in his lap, but so far there was no sign of the rebels that Black had warned them about.
"There is no left turn. Just a bunch of stalls," Claudia said, weaving through the pedestrians clogging the dirt street.
Instead of going directly to the abandoned safari hotel his people had retreated to, they were taking a circuitous route to a building behind Black's repurposed church. The fact that the instructions he'd provided didn't match the GPS map wasn't all that surprising. Google's cartographers had good reason to avoid Juba. It did, however, add to the suspicion lodged in the back of Rapp's mind. Could Black be leading him into a trap? Was it possible that Nassar had somehow managed to locate the young sniper and make him an offer he couldn't refuse? Or even more likely, had Black initiated contact with the authorities himself? He wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed, but he was sure as hell sharp enough to know that Rapp's scalp was about to become a very hot commodity on the world market.
"Mitch, what do you want me to do?"
They could just find their own path, but that had its own risks. Rapp's knowledge of the town was limited, and its layout was constantly evolving. Impromptu markets sprang up and disappeared. Buildings collapsed and were replaced with temporary structures. Roads were rerouted and commandeered. He assumed that the agency had updated maps, but he didn't have access to them anymore. "Just take the next left you come to." He checked again for signal on his cell, and again got nothing.
"Do you think Kent's betrayed us?"
"Maybe. But I'm betting against it. It's possible that he could get lucky and take out Donatella, but Grisha? More likely it's just Africa."
"Likely, but not certain,"
she said, looking a bit worried. "This job just keeps getting worse, doesn't it?"
I know. You warned me."
She swung the car onto a narrow path between buildings and the GPS recalibrated. They were back on the right track. After about 100 yards, a man ran out of a doorway to their right and jogged toward the car. The white face was immediately recognizable, and Rapp tightened his grip on his Glock as Kent Black yanked open the back door.
"Where have you two been?" he said, ducking inside. "I was sweating my ass off out there."
"Your directions took a little artistic license," Claudia said.
"You can't find shit in this town from one day to another. Just keep going. Next right, there's an old gate. We'll be going through it and parking on the other side."
The barrier opened as they approached, and Rapp spotted Grisha Azarov behind. By the time they'd parked, the Russian had the gate locked down again.
"We've got a decent view of the church from the top floor," Black said, getting out and leading them into a building that looked to be on the verge of buckling.
Many of the walls had crumbled, and about half of the third floor was now lying on the second. Despite that, a number of people had taken up residence, mostly families, some cooking over fires, others trying to stay out of the sun, but all paying a lot of attention to the four white people in their midst.
"What's the story with the people living here?" Rapp asked, slowing to let Azarov pass. He still didn't like having the man behind him.
"They've got no love for Abdu, if that's what you mean," Black said. "He's the reason most of them are homeless, and we're paying them 10 times more to keep quiet than that scumbag would ever pay them to talk. We're good."
They came out on the top floor and found Donatella standing in the shade on the north end.
"Mitch," she said, throwing her arms around him. "I was starting to worry."
Claudia's expression hardened. She was wearing dusty cargo shorts and a sweat-soaked t-shirt, while Donatella looked like she'd just come from the Queen's garden party.
"Show me the church," Rapp said, leaving the two women to stare at each other.
Black led, dropping to his stomach a few yards from the edge of the floor and slithering toward a missing section of wall. There was a pair of Zeiss binoculars hanging on a column, and Rapp used them to scan the area around their former headquarters. Abdo's men weren't wearing their customary dirty fatigues, having changed into civilian clothes. Still, they stood out. While everyone else in town seemed to have something to do or somewhere to go, they were just standing around, scanning the passing faces. "How many in total?" Rapp said.
"We've made 5, 3 on the ground and 2 in buildings east and west. Probably at least 1 inside, but there's no way to know. 12-hour shifts, ending around midnight and noon."
"I told you, Mitch, you shouldn't have killed Nanomi. These guys don't mess around, and they know how to hold a grudge."
"Is there anything inside the building I need to worry about?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, did you leave anything in there about us?"
"Nothing about you. Just my whole life, that's all."
They slid back to where the others were waiting.
"It looks like we're going to have to leave this horrible place," Donatella observed. "May I suggest Sardinia? Easy to get lost in, good food, and the weather's lovely this time of the year."
"We're staying here," Rapp responded.
"But Mitch, those security videos from Monaco are making their rounds to the world's intelligence agencies, and I'm guessing I've already been ID'd," he said, cutting her off. Once she got to complaining, it was almost impossible to get her to stop.
"Claudia and Kent aren't on them, so they're probably okay. Grisha, are you confident you talked your way out of this?"
"For now," the Russian responded. "But as a consulting company executive, it would be better if I'm not filmed in a similar performance anytime soon."
Rapp nodded. "That leaves you, Donatella."
"Me? You think the Mossad isn't going to recognize you?"
"Of course they will. I've hardly aged a day.
But the people I worked for are dead or retired. There would be no profit in moving against me."
"And if the video goes public?"
"Then some people from my past will know I'm alive. Not ideal, but manageable with your help."
Rapp turned to Claudia. "We'll stay at the Safari Hotel and see how much shit hits the fan over the next few days. But I need you to work out an alternate location for us."
"I'll have it taken care of by tomorrow night."
Rapp folded his arms across his chest and scanned the faces staring back at him.
Claudia was right.
He was moving into uncharted territory with a group of misfits whose motivations were all over the place. It was a problem that needed to be acknowledged before they continued.
"This job was about getting Talal bin Musaid and transporting him to a location where I could question him. We've now moved well outside of those operational parameters. It appears that the Saudi intelligence chief, Ali Nassar, is the one calling the shots. Now he's killing the people close to him, and doing a pretty good job of framing me for it. I don't have to tell you that politicians don't like these kinds of scenarios. The amount of money, influence, and potential embarrassment we're talking about is going to make them scramble for cover."
"What does that mean exactly?" Black said. Donatella answered.
"It means that all of the people who used to be Mitch's friends are now his enemies. We're about to have the CIA, the U.S. military, MI6, Saudi intelligence, and the Mossad come down on us like a ton of bricks."
"That's pretty accurate," Rapp said. "At the scale we're talking about now, I become expendable."
"And if you're expendable," Donatella continued, "then we're just bugs to be stepped on without second thought."
Rapp nodded. "Look, it wasn't my intention to sign you on for anything like this, and if you want to walk away, I'll understand. You'll be paid whatever we agreed on, and I'll never give up your names."
"When you say walk away," Azarov said, "walk away from what? What do you plan to do?"
"Deal with Nassar. He's been busy cleaning up after himself, but now he's going to turn his attention to me."
"So you want to kill him?" Azarov said.
"I definitely want to kill him, but it's going to be complicated."
"Complicated how?" Black said.
"Why don't I just fly to Saudi Arabia and put a bullet in him from half a mile away?"
I don't think he's going to make it that easy, Rapp said. And it would blow back against Mitch, Claudia added. So far, he actually is innocent. Executing the Saudi intelligence chief would very much alter the chessboard.
Then what? Azarov said. I'm still working on that.
How confidence-inspiring, Donatella said. The Russian disagreed. I've been involved in a number of these kinds of operations, and acting rashly is a recipe for disaster. Mitch is right to consider every possibility before making a move. Ali Nassar isn't a Taliban enforcer or suicide bomber. He's a brilliant man, with virtually unlimited resources.
So, who's in and who's out? Rapp said.
Donatella was the first to speak. After everything we've been through, I'd never abandon you.
The implication was clear, that he'd abandoned her. And maybe it was true. But that was a reflection for another time.
Hell, I live for this shit, Black said with his customary bravado. I'm in for whatever you figure out.
Azarov remained silent for a few seconds before speaking.
I like to finish what I start. And frankly, I'm not sure that Nassar won't have more questions for me about what happened in Monaco. I'd prefer to see him neutralized.
Rapp looked over at Claudia.
You know my answer.
Chapter 39. The White House, Washington, D.C., USA.
I want to be perfectly clear, Irene. You believe that was Mitch in the Monaco video.
President Joshua Alexander gazed at her over the resolute desk. His expression was serious, perhaps even grave, but something in it hinted at fear, as it should. Irene Kennedy had always liked and respected the man. He was pragmatic, understood the threats facing the country, and listened to advice. When necessary, he was also willing to look the other way. That said, it was her experience that people could change very quickly when their backs were against the wall. It was a transformation that tended to occur even faster in politicians. My people put the likelihood at 95%. She herself put it at 100, but there was no reason to say that. Alexander was unaware that she knew about his early morning meeting with Mitch Rapp. And while Rapp had said nothing about what had been discussed, he also had done nothing to prevent her from coming to the obvious conclusion. What was he doing there, Irene? I was told he left the CIA. Is that not the case? Is he working for you?
She found this charade a bit insulting, and considered telling the president that she was perfectly aware that it was he who had set Rapp on this path. As satisfying as that would be, though, it would also be extraordinarily unwise. As usual, she had no choice but to swallow her anger and play the games that politics required. Mitch gave me his resignation, and I have not been in contact with him since. To the best of my knowledge, no one at the agency has.
So you don't know where he is?
I have no idea, she responded honestly.
Well, that piece of shit Ali Nassar is going to be here in less than 2 minutes, and he's not going to be happy with that answer.
Mitch Rapp is no longer my concern, nor the concern of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's a private citizen who happened to be in a European establishment when it was attacked by terrorists. I saw nothing in that video to suggest that Mitch, if that's indeed who it was, did anything criminal. If Director Nassar wants to talk to him, then he's free to find him and request a meeting.
You're not going to seriously sit there and tell me it was just a coincidence that Mitch was there when those terrorists attacked, Alexander said.
She just took a sip of her tea.
The enhanced video from Monaco had been three of the most interesting minutes of film she'd ever watched. Kennedy was extremely surprised by the presence of Grisha Azarov, whom everyone had dismissed as the luckiest extraction consultant in history. Seeing him work was quite extraordinary, and went a long way to explaining how he had managed to injure Scott Coleman so badly. Even more shocking had been the presence of Donatella Ron. She still hadn't been identified, and even the CIA's analysts were speculating that she was nothing more than an Eastern European prostitute. And that left the unknown sniper who had been ensconced on the top floor of an apartment to the west. All they had of him was poor security camera footage, depicting a man of average height and build wearing a bulky coat, a hat and large eyeglasses opaque to surveillance equipment. She'd quietly looked into a number of men whom she thought Rapp might have recruited, but, to her old friend's credit, had come up empty. Was it possible that he'd solicited the help of Kent Black? She knew that the former ranger was selling arms in Africa, but there had never been any reason to keep tabs on him.
"You seem even more guarded than usual, Irene. Is there something you're not telling me? Is there something you're not telling me, Mr. President?"
She regretted the words the moment they came out of her mouth. The unwavering control that had served her so well in her career was beginning to fail. One of the most courageous, patriotic, and effective American operatives ever born had been put in a position that was likely fatal, and there was very little she could do to change that. Alexander refused to acknowledge it. But there was only one course this meeting could take. Mitch Rapp, the man who was like a brother to her and who had sacrificed everything for his country, was going to be thrown to the wolves.
"What are you trying to say, Irene?"
She was saved from having to answer by the president's assistant poking her head in.
"Sir, Director Nassar has arrived."
Alexander stood behind his desk. "Show him in." Nassar looked a bit less smug and significantly more tired than the last time they'd met. He shook hands with Alexander, but decided to dispense with that pleasantry when turning to face Kennedy.
"King Faisal wants to know what your involvement with Mitch Rapp is, and what is being done about him."
"Could you be more specific, Director?"
"You know exactly what I'm talking about. His involvement with the terrorist attack in Monaco and the kidnapping, perhaps even murder, of Prince Talal bin Musayyid."
She allowed an intentionally unconvincing expression of shock to cross her face.
"You're suggesting the man in that nightclub was Mitch Rapp?"
"There's videotape."
"Really? And is that videotape conclusive?" she said,
quoting Nassar's own words when he'd been faced with the existence of photographic evidence that bin Musayyid was financing terrorists in Morocco.
"We believe it is,"
Nassar said, a brief flash in his eyes registering the insult.
"We—"
"Director, why don't we sit for a moment?" the president interrupted. He led them to a seating area and they all settled in. Alexander should have been enjoying turning the tables on the Saudi. Instead, he was calculating every possible way Rapp's actions could blow back on him. It wasn't lost on Kennedy that it would be far better for him if the former CIA agent disappeared forever. As Stan Hurley had been fond of saying, "Dead men tell no tales."
"I demand that we dispense with these games immediately," Nassar said. "Everyone in this room knows that the man in that video is Rapp."
"I know no such thing," Kennedy retorted, "and even if it is, the man in that video is killing the terrorists and appears to be trying to save the prince."
"Save him? He threw His Highness into the street where he was gunned down like an animal."
"Gunned down by the men in the pursuing car. Perhaps the prince was already dead. I think it's fair to say that it would be quite disturbing to have a dead body in one's passenger seat."
"Disturbing? Don't be absurd. A man like the one in that video wouldn't be bothered by the presence of a dead body in his car."
She just shrugged.
Nassar pulled two photos from the portfolio he was carrying and handed them to her.
"Since you're not satisfied by the quality of the pictures captured from that video, Director Kennedy, perhaps you'll find these more convincing."
Each depicted a bloody corpse secured to a chair. She tapped the top one. "Ahmed Al-Hashem."
We were very sorry to hear about your assistant ambassador's death, the president interjected.
I'm sure you were, Nassar remarked in an openly disrespectful tone. He was tortured, likely for information, and then executed with a single shot to the head from what my people are saying was probably a Glock. The second man, Maya Zaman, suffered the same fate.
Maya Zaman? Kennedy said. Who is he?
A Saudi businessman.
She pulled out her phone and Googled the name as he continued. It was just for show, though. She was extremely familiar with Mr. Zaman.
He was killed at a Brussels hotel, as was one of the hotel's security people. Further, the murderer, who fits Mitch Rapp's description, incapacitated two more security guards on his way out of the building before being driven away by a Caucasian woman.
Do you have photographic evidence? Kennedy asked.
Rapp disabled the cameras when he killed the security guard.
So, a 6-foot, bearded, dark-complected male in his 40s. That narrows it down to about 250 million people.
Don't be a fool. You know as well as I do that this is Mitch Rapp's doing. He believed that Prince Bin Musaid was involved with ISIS, and he's interrogating and murdering men he perceives to be connected.
And why would he perceive these men to be connected? He didn't reply, and Kennedy continued to scroll through her phone.
This is interesting. It says that Zaman is about your age and went to Oxford. Did you know him?
We were roommates.
Really, she said, looking up and affecting an expression of sympathy. Then I'm very sorry for the loss of your friend.
This is all irrelevant, the Saudi said, trying to regain control of the conversation. Whether this is or is not the work of Mitch Rapp is a matter that's easily resolved. All we need to do is speak with him.
Then I'd encourage you to do that, Kennedy said.
Where would I find him?
I'm not in the habit of keeping track of my former employees.
Nassar finally turned his attention to the president, who for obvious reasons was content to let his CIA chief take the lead.
Sir, you know as well as I do that Mitch Rapp is involved in this. The man was always unstable and violent, and now he's gone rogue. King Faisal demands that he be found before he can kill any more of our citizens. If we discover that he wasn't involved, of course we'll provide both you and him a formal apology. Until then, though, I think we can make the assumption that he'll keep killing until he's stopped. Because of the king's deep respect for you and his acknowledgement of Mr. Rapp's past contributions to our security, we're willing to keep this quiet. If you refuse to help, however, we'll be forced to make this information public and seek the help of the world's law enforcement agencies.
Even Alexander couldn't hide his increased apprehension at the word public. He turned to Kennedy.
Irene, can you get in touch with him? Ask him to come in for an interview.
Probably not, she said vaguely.
Nassar's jaw clenched.
Mr. President, I am formally asking for your government's help in finding Mr. Rapp. If he's innocent, he'll have an opportunity to clear his name. If he's not, his capture will prevent any further bloodshed.
Checkmate, Kennedy knew.
Refusing the perfectly reasonable request would be a political disaster, and would force Alexander to manufacture a rationale for that refusal that would be too far-fetched to play on the world stage. It's what she had feared since the day the president sent Rapp on this fool's errand.
What is it you need? Alexander said.
For you to provide my task force with a man who can assist and who can act as a liaison between my people and yours.
Alexander looked at Kennedy. Irene, could you provide someone?
Of course. Perhaps, with all due respect, sir, I already have someone in mind.
Who?
Special Agent Joel Wilson of the FBI.
Kennedy's heart sank at the name.
Wilson was the former acting deputy director of counterintelligence, a twisted little man who hated rap with the same intensity as many of his terrorist enemies. Worse, he was an extremely competent and obsessive investigator. Nassar had once again proved his cunning. Wilson would abandon all common sense, all perspective, and all national loyalty for an opportunity to exact revenge on Rapp. "I don't know him," the president said, standing. "But if that's who you want, fine." Nassar stood as well, shaking the man's hand and giving a curt nod to Kennedy before heading for the door. When it closed behind him, Alexander turned to her. "Joel Wilson. Who the fuck is that?" "You remember him, sir. He worked with Senator Ferris against us when—
"That little prick? The idiot who the Pakistanis used to try to take out the CIA's clandestine services?"
"Yes, sir." "I still can't understand why you didn't put that bastard in jail and throw away the key." "It was less complicated not to. We didn't want to give the FBI a black eye, and tensions with Pakistan were already bad enough. We demoted him and agreed to let him keep his pension. To the best of my knowledge, he's working at one of the FBI's resident agencies. Montana, maybe? Or it could be Alaska." Alexander dropped back into the couch.
"What do you know about all this, Irene?
I'm not buying that you came up with Zaman and Nassar going to school together from your phone."
"No, sir, I didn't."
"Give me your best guess on this, Irene. What's Mitch's involvement?" She smiled easily, hiding her anger at Alexander for having the audacity to so calmly ask her that question. It seems self-evident that Mitch was at that nightclub, watching Bin Musaid. Based on our analysis of the video, what happened there wasn't a random terrorist attack. They were there to get Bin Musaid. Rapp saw it happening during his surveillance and intervened.
"So what about Al-Hashem and Zaman? Is it possible that Bin Musaid fingered them when he was in the car with Mitch and that Mitch decided to deal with them on his own? We both know how opposed he was to the arrangement that was made after 9/11.
"It's possible, but unlikely. Leaving aside Al-Hashem for the moment, Zaman's death in Brussels implies that Mitch murdered a security guard. There's nothing in his history to suggest he'd do something like that."
"But then he's never gone rogue before, either."
She let that go, but her anger notched higher. "If you don't think it's too immoral for Mitch, sir, then I'd argue that it's simply too sloppy. Once that guard was killed, the clock would be ticking on his body being discovered. There would be no time to carry out an effective interrogation."
"So what then?"
"A much more likely scenario is that whoever was behind Prince Bin Musaid's actions in Morocco is getting rid of everyone who knows his identity, and framing Mitch for it."
"Are you sure you're not letting your friendship with him cloud your judgment?"
"Let me ask you something, sir. How many times have I told you I was certain of something?"
"Never. You're the master of the hedge."
"Well, I'm certain Mitch is not responsible for the death of that hotel security guard. And if he didn't do it, someone else did."
"Okay. Who?"
"If I had to guess, Ali Nassar."
"Is that a joke?"
"Not at all. Nassar is an ambitious man. He'll want to be on the winning side when Faisal dies, and he might see ISIS as a critical backer. Frankly, he might be right."
"Can you contact Mitch in a way that no one can track?"
"I don't know if Mitch would take my call, and there's no such thing as completely secure communications, particularly if Nassar knows more than he's telling us."
"Then don't. You can't be seen as having any involvement in this."
He sank a little deeper into the cushions and let out a long breath.
"I can't believe that Mitch would do something like this without authorization, Irene."
She stared directly at him when she answered, "Neither can I." For the first time in their relationship, the most powerful man in the world wouldn't meet her eye.
Chapter 40.
Bismarck, North Dakota, USA. Ali Nassar stayed in the car, looking past his driver at distant snow-capped mountains. He had sent his security detail back to Saudi Arabia and replaced them with a team of Secret Service men provided by the president. All were too young to have much experience, but also too young to have a relationship with Mitch Rapp. The fact that the CIA man had appeared at Zaman's hotel virtually guaranteed that he was aware of Nassar's role in the financing of ISIS. And if that was true, he would be coming. Nassar was now engaged in mortal combat with a man who had never lost such a confrontation. It had been proved over and over again that brute force would fail against Rapp. The only hope was to outmaneuver him, and the Secret Service men were an effort to do just that. Rapp would be reluctant to use deadly force against the American security detail, while they would have no such misgivings where he was concerned. It was far from being an assurance, but it was the most logical course of action while he was on U.S. soil. The Secret Service agents had spread out on the street and were scanning the light traffic with practiced eyes. Finally, two of them disappeared into a coffee shop to the north. Nassar had wasted no time getting to Bismarck, going directly to his plane from his meeting at the Oval Office. Despite this, it was certain that Irene Kennedy knew of his whereabouts. Was that duplicitous bitch involved? Had she quietly sent Rapp Nassar's flight plan? Was the CIA assassin out there, clean-shaven and blending in with the slack-jawed farmers? Nassar's phone rang, and he looked at the secure number, initially moving to dismiss it, but then thinking better. He needed a distraction and would have to speak to the man soon anyway. Nassar slid down in his seat a few more inches and picked up.
Hello, Kader. Zaman and El Hashem are dead, and you haven't been returning my calls, came the panicked response. Rumors are that Mitch Rapp was involved. Is there any truth to this?
I'm afraid there is.
What action are you taking? He screeched. I demand that, Kader, be calm. Calm? How can you even say this to me? I'm told that you're in America with heavy security. I'm at my home with my wife and children. He could walk in here at any moment and—
You think I'm safer in America? Nassar cut in angrily.
In his home country? Quit acting like an old woman. Are you afraid to meet God after having done his work? Is there some reason for you to fear his judgment?
The man didn't respond, and Nassar softened his tone. He needed Kader to hold together for just a bit longer. I already have a security team watching you, your house, and your family. But because this situation is escalating, it's going to be necessary to move you. A safe house is being set up for you near Ararat. You'll be collected tonight and moved there until I can deal with the Rapp situation.
Deal with the Rapp situation? How many people have said that in the past, Ali? Just how do you intend to deal with the Rapp situation?
Kader Sultan was the last man who knew of Nassar's direct involvement with ISIS, and as such, was currently the second greatest threat to him. While it was true that two Saudi intelligence officers would retrieve him that night, neither they nor Sultan would ever arrive at the safe house. Instead, their bodies would be discovered by the side of the road, each with a single bullet wound to the head. I said, I'm dealing with it, Kader. How is not your concern? One of the Secret Service men exited the coffee shop and signaled that it was secure, prompting Nassar to disconnect the call. He got out of the car, fighting the urge to crouch as he walked. The sense of relief he felt when he stepped off the exposed street and into the building was palpable. The tiny restaurant was only about half full, and Joel Wilson was eating a sandwich near its center. Nassar approached and leaned down in order to speak to him at a level that would be inaudible to the other patrons.
Special Agent Wilson, I wonder if I might have a word with you.
He looked up from the tablet he was reading and spoke with a full mouth.
I'm having lunch. What do you want?
I'm Ali Nassar.
Is that supposed to mean something to me?
I don't guess it would. I'm the chief of Saudi Arabia's General Intelligence Directorate. That captured the man's attention, but he remained understandably skeptical. Just out touring the Dakotas, are you?